morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit that operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. This episode is coming to you from Bookmarks Festival of Books and Authors, the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. My guest today is Robin Sloan. Robin's debut novel, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, was a New York Times bestseller and has become one of the classic novels about books. His much-anticipated follow-up, published this week, is Sourdough. Robin, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Charlie, thank you. It's such an honor to join you here.
I have to say, it's a thrill for me to finally meet you. When my first novel was coming out, you were one of the first authors to write a blurb for it, and I ran right out and bought a copy of Mr. Penumbra and just fell in love with it. Now, both of your novels feature some pretty amazing technology, and you describe yourself as a writer and media inventor who, and I'm quoting from your website here, dorks around with technology. So my question is, first of all, what is a media inventor, and what sort of technology do you dork around with?
Those are both very good questions, foundational questions. I'll approach them in order. I think a media inventor is someone, and this is not actually uncommon, it's someone who is interested in the content, of course, words, pictures, the script, you know, the story, the theme, but they're also interested in the container. And I guess what I mean is that they're not content to just take whatever kind of the reigning form of the moment is, whether it's the novel or the novella or the, you know, Netflix series, but they want to tinker with that. That's how we get new forms, after all, people experimenting with the way that we tell stories. So that's what a media inventor is, and I've always been one of those people. I'm just fascinated by form and the ways that we can change it and maybe mutate it. And then for me, the technology is usually something connected to the internet. Not always, but I'm just one of those people of the generation that kind of grew up with the internet, graduating from bulletin board services that you reached via a, screeching little modem to America Online, to, you know, my first high-speed internet connection in college. And of course, now the internet kind of is sort of everywhere in the air around us. And so for me, technology has usually meant delivering stories or kind of thinking about how stories play out in that landscape.
So you see yourself as a digital native?
I actually don't, to tell you the truth. That's only because I dispute the term somewhat. I feel like just my own experience has kind of shown me that affinity and certainly skill, but especially that kind of affection for these tools and technologies is very evenly distributed across generations. I know some extremely crotchety young people who would probably prefer that the internet didn't exist. And I know people decades older than me who are actually much more fluent with all these social networks. So yeah. I think it's a little more chaotic than that.
So when the heroine of Sourdough arrives in San Francisco from the Midwest, she says a great line, which really stuck with me. She writes that California has a Z-axis. She's talking about the landscape of California. But how does your background in technology, do you think, affect your writing on a syntax level?
That's a great question. I'll tell you the answer, or at least part of the answer that's clear to me, and it's actually not great. It's something I've had to sort of work against. When you write on the internet, especially in the days of the blog, which have passed in some ways, but certainly in the early 2000s, maybe until the early 2010s, this was like a very like significant and impactful way for people to write and to find an audience. I mean, that's the important part. There was an audience out there for people writing blogs and linking to each other's blogs. There was this sort of republic of letters, you know, that kind of happened on the internet. And it was an exciting time to be writing in that way. However, you were always conscious of the fact that people had a lot to read, and you imagined that everyone else was reading the same way that you were, which is to say with a line of tabs open across the top of their browser. And, you know, if you went on too long or kind of lost the thread, then people would just close the tab because there was something else waiting for them to read, waiting to be read. So there's no question that awareness of the limits on people's attention and sort of being in competition with everything else that's out there waiting to be read influenced my early fiction. I think in early stories and even in Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, I think you can detect a almost kind of a nervousness bordering on panic, that if you don't get on with it, the reader is going to like slam the book closed and move on to the next thing. Of course, that's not actually how people read novels. You know, once they kind of get in the door, they want to luxuriate a bit and spend their time with the author and the author's voice. And I've learned that now. So I've, in some ways, I've had to kind of undo some of those habits that served me so well in my early writing.
Right, right. So in Penumbra, we see the world of physical and often old books, a very ancient technology juxtaposed with this modern digital technology. Here in Sourdough, we have the handcraft of baking bread, also brushing up against the world of coding and robot arms. How do you see the digital and analog worlds working together or not working together as we move forward?
Boy, that's a big question. I think it's complicated, and I don't know that I have a great answer or any great prognostication, but the thing that I'm sure of anything is this. Nothing goes away. There's a model of sort of technological succession, a real simplistic model that imagines that, you know, the ebook replaces the book, and then something else replaces the ebook, and we kind of skip. It's almost like jumping from one stone to the next as we cross the river, leaving, you know, the past behind. And of course, it doesn't work that way. Instead of sort of this succession, it's more of an accretion. Like, it's like we're traveling across the country in a little station wagon and just throwing more and more things into the back seat. And we never like clean it out. There are some exceptions. I mean, I think some media formats really are gone or almost gone. I think of like the music CD. It just turns out there's not a lot of space for the music
CD. The 8-track tape.
Yeah. And so of course there are exceptions to this rule, but in general, you look at the analog and the digital and just this whole panoply of tools for recording things and then redistributing them and experiencing them. And when I think about the future, I think you have to start by imagining that it's all still going to be there, rubbing shoulders against itself.
Yeah. I find it very interesting when I'm out on tour, and a lot of times I get questions about e-books versus physical books, and I'm finding that more and more often my younger readers are the ones who are most enthusiastically attached to the physical book.
Absolutely, and I mean, this is at this point, it's kind of been well publicized and remarked upon, but vinyl records have had this incredible resurgence. I mean, they're selling better than they have in many, many decades. And I don't think that's just a fluke of nostalgia or some last gasp of, you know, rich hipsters who are kind of indulging in this, you know, in these cases of musical trophies. I actually think it's something real and something durable.
So I've been kind of skirting around the issue that we should really be talking about today, which is how delightful this new novel is. It's really hard to follow up, you know, a very popular, well-received first novel with something that's going to appeal to the readership base that you've already created, but also do something new. And I think you've really succeeded in that. Tell us the basic premise of Sourdough.
Sure. Sourdough opens with a young software engineer named Lois Clary. She's from Michigan originally, but she's been lured out to the San Francisco Bay Area by a very exciting, interesting new job at a company that manufactures robot arms for laboratories and factories. And the whole experience is just not what she expects. It's stressful. She feels like maybe she's not actually well suited to the nature of the work and the workplace. And, you know, against the backdrop of this stress, she finds her solace in this little restaurant, this strange little restaurant that bakes a great loaf of sourdough bread and makes a really wonderful spicy soup. Fast forward, she ends up the inheritor of its bubbling sourdough starter, which of course, as the story progresses, it quickly turns out that it has some mysterious properties and is more than it seems to be at first. And her possession of this starter and then her early investigations into baking with it essentially lure her into the world of Bay Area food, which, like most subcultures in the San Francisco Bay Area, is just so deep and so weird, and it's like the rabbit hole leads you to a maze, and then suddenly you're like, you know, on another planet.
So I can't resist phrasing this question this way, but would you give us a taste of sourdough?
Sure, of course. This is actually right after Lois has baked her first loaf of sourdough bread. She's astonished at the whole process and kind of amazed that it worked at all. She brings it into work to share it with her few friends at this robot factory, These friends, they're united by one common bond, which is that all of them are really frustrated and kind of overwhelmed by food, and so they've found refuge in a kind of nutritive gel. It's a meal replacement, so they just don't have to think about what to eat. Just every day for lunch, they have this this kind of gray nutritive paste called slurry. So this is the slurry gang sitting at the slurry table in the cafeteria. Lois has been a slurry slurper as well, but today she shows up with a loaf of sourdough bread, and this is what happens. At the slurry table, when I unveiled my gift, Peter scooched his chair back apprehensively. "I don't eat bread," he reminded us. He said it like a ward against evil. The other slurry slurpers had no such compunctions. The slices I had sawed were thick and fluffy, and we slathered them with sour plum jam swiped from Chef Kate's fancy toast station. Garrett relished the sourdough most of all. The sounds he made were borderline NSFW. "You made this?" he said, mouth agape. "Like, from a kit? Did it come frozen?" Garrett lived in one of the new microcube apartment buildings on Sansom Street, and his living space didn't have any kind of kitchen. Instead, it offered a wall-mounted touchscreen connected to various delivery services, expedited to sub-5-minute timescales through a contract with the building's owner. Garrett operated at a level of abstraction from food that made me look like Ina Garten. I explained the process by which Living Sourdough Starter gave the bread its texture and its flavor. Garrett's eyes were wide with disbelief. "It was alive," he said softly, wonderingly. He, like me, had never before considered where bread came from or why it looked the way it did. And this was us, our time and place. We could wrestle sophisticated robots into submission, but were confounded by the most basic processes of life.
That's great. Now, I have to tell you, so my wife and I both read your book, and since that, we did that about 3 weeks ago, we've been going through loaves of sourdough like potato chips from a bakery here in Winston-Salem. In fact, when you come to our house for dinner tonight, there's going to be sourdough on the table.
Fantastic.
But I wanted to know, what role has food, and in particular bread, if any, played in your life?
Well, I have to confess that the book, especially as it opens and we kind of learn about Lois's situation, the way she thinks about food, the way it stresses her out and overwhelms her, that's pretty autobiographical. That was my condition, I would say, as recently as maybe 7 or 8 years ago when I was living in San Francisco. You know, I moved there from Michigan, and I mean, I liked food, of course. I liked good meals and I liked slices of pizza, but just the process of feeding myself, figuring out what I was going to eat, how I was going to like kind of answer that rumble in the belly around, you know, 1 or 2 p.m. every day. This is kind of the most indicative thing, maybe. You'd play that parlor game to kill time or break the ice where people ask, you know, what superpower would you have, you know, if you were a comic book superhero? And like the correct answer to that question is like, I would fly, or like, oh, I wish I could turn invisible, or, you know, I wish I could shoot lightning bolts out of my eyes. And my answer, always without fail, was, oh, I wish I could photosynthesize, because it would be so easy. Of course, that answer was often regarded with sort of horror or pity, and I can report that I understand that now. I've come a long way with help from some good guides and, you know, just a lot more experience in the kitchen and baking and cooking and just doing all sorts of things, tasting more things. But I guess I put that experience and that feeling, which, you know, I don't know if it's common, but I don't think it's uncommon. You know, I think there are people out there, especially younger people, who kind of have that feeling of like, what am I supposed to eat? And especially in the 21st century, and especially in America. And so I put that straight into Lois.
Yeah. So I think penumbra and sourdough both take on what, to me, are intensely personal subjects, what we read and what we eat. How would you compare writing about books with writing about food?
Well, there's no question that at its core, writing Penumbra was maybe not easier, but more natural. I mean, I just felt like the material and, you know, the things that the characters said, the way they expressed these feelings about books and what they do, I mean, those were all coming from my own decades of experience of being a reader. There wasn't really research necessary, only, you know, except for just the deepest little nooks and crannies of publishing history and, you know, these little bits of arcane history from centuries ago. Sourdough was also natural, as I described. I mean, I had had these experiences with food and I'd had this sort of education, re-education with food over the last 7 or 8 years. But particularly when it came to the rest of that culture, you know, what people do with it, how they talk about it, and the history, you know, like the, especially the specific history of Bay Area food, that required some real research, like sitting down and reading the histories. And that was new for me. I had not done that for a book, and it was a new challenge, but a fun one.
Did you find yourself in the middle of writing having to stop and cut a slab of sourdough bread?
No, I mean, that's funny. I actually had OD'd on sourdough bread, like, well before I even began the book Sourdough. I had a sourdough starter of my own. I learned to bake from a book that's very similar to the one that I describe Lois using in this novel. And it was, I mean, as I describe in the novel, it's fun and it's magical. And you can bake as much as you want. And so it is really easy to go too far, and I definitely did. And even now, I need to kind of just deliberately pace my bread consumption because I ate a lot for a few years there.
So to stay on the issue of the starter itself for a minute, in my novels, often I have a rare book that I treat like a character.
Yeah.
Did you see Lois's sourdough starter as a character?
You know, I think that is one of the most fun and interesting things you can do, particularly in a novel, because you don't even have to kind of walk that line that they do in film or on stage of like, well, is it really a character? You know, like what is it really? You can play with it and kind of create this, an aura almost around, you know, anything, an object, a place, a building, or, you know, in my case, a little ceramic crock full of like a bubbling slime. That was definitely my intention. I find it delightful whenever people do that, whenever you get the sense that this, you know, thing that is not supposed to be a character or like wouldn't really be a character with a voice and a will in our world can kind of have one on the page. And I'm not sure of this. It's hard to verify, of course, because I haven't read every book ever published, but I'm pretty sure that Sourdough is the first novel in English to feature a sourdough starter as like a main supporting character.
And it has a mystery to it too. I mean, Lois can never quite figure out what's going on with the starter without giving too much away.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, that's a reflection of what I have experienced as the real mystery of not only sourdough starters, but all of these sort of microbial communities that give us all these delicious foods. I mean, this was all new to me again over the course of the last many years now. I had just never paused to consider how all the things that I like best, like cheese and beer and like wine and everything. Yeah, I mean, cured meats. I had no idea. This stuff is all, these are like the products of these amazing microbial factories, and they all have different characteristics and indeed different secrets.
So is cooking then uniquely suited to a Robin Sloan book because it's this perfect match of craft and science?
Well, that's I don't know if it's perfectly suited. It has the craft, it has the science, and it also has the history. And for me, I mean, I think you can see this in both books. What has interested me about history in all these domains that I've tackled has been not just the, you know, people did a thing at a time and that's interesting, but recognizing that, you know, at all these points along the story, even 100 years ago or many hundreds of years ago, we're talking about technology and sort of reframing things that often get talked about in very kind of nostalgic and warm and like comforting terms. And I think that applies to both old books, which we know well and have thought about deeply, and certainly it applies to things that happen in the kitchen too. It's like very, very easy to kind of put this stuff into that box of like, oh, isn't it great? Oh, I love that old stuff. And I really like kind of emptying out the box's contents and saying, no, this is technology, and it's actually strange, and there was a moment when it was new and dangerous, and right. I don't know, I find that exciting.
I mean, I think often about the first person who said, oh, the milk has gone bad, let's eat it. Oh, it's cheese.
Exactly, exactly, yeah, there's great courage involved in these moments.
So there's a cultural group in your book and it's spelled M-A-Z-G. So first of all, tell me how to pronounce it.
I say it Mazg, and, okay. And in my mind, the longer you can draw out the Z and the more then it can kind of swallow the G, the better. The Mazg.
So tell us a little bit about this particular cultural group.
So the Mazg, again, this is something drawn from real life, although in a slightly loopier way. I lived on a street in San Francisco called Clement Street for a couple years, my favorite place I ever lived in the city. In this book, Lois lives near Clement Street, and she kind of describes it a few times. It is truly, I think, one of the great streets in the United States and maybe the world. It's just a totally polyglot avenue full of everything you can imagine, you know, grocery stores and restaurants and bars. The best bookstore in San Francisco, Green Apple Books, is on Clement Street, which is important. Bakeries and coffee shops, and importantly, storefronts that you don't really know what they are. You're like, what? What are they selling here? You know, the sign is in a script you don't recognize. The smells are not smells that you can quite place, and that's fantastic. Like, for me, it was like truly nourishment just to walk up and down Clement Street. One of the fun things about the street is that, again, for me, you know, as a new San Francisco transplant, there were languages being spoken and scripts printed on signs that I didn't know them, but I didn't even know what they were, where they were from. Over time, you learn, like, oh, that's Burmese, and oh, that's a Burmese restaurant, and oh, Burmese food is delicious. But I liked the idea of conjuring a culture that could be alien to everyone, right. You know, kind of a perfectly foreign other. And, you know, sure enough, their script is described as this sort of strange combination and that looks, you know, almost, you know, Eastern European, but also Cyrillic, but also like, oh, is that like a Japanese character? Like, what are we dealing with here? And then, of course, they're the custodians of this strange starter.
Right. So at one point, is it Bayo? Is that how you pronounce
Bayo,
it?
Bayo, yeah.
Bayo, who is part of this culture, says to Lois, he remarks that she is unencumbered by culture. What do you think it means to be unencumbered by culture?
Well, particularly in the context of food and cuisine, I think it's really, really important. It's actually, I think, one of the most important things about America, I tell you the truth, and the way Americans eat. I think of this so often. This connects back to that stress I was talking about, the frustration of feeding yourself. I don't know this for sure, but I just really believe that far more young Americans, you know, 20-something Americans in strange cities feel the feeling that I described to you than do Italians or young Japanese people or even young German people. And it's because those places have cuisines. You know, they have these like deep sort of understandings of like what it is you're supposed to eat for a bunch of reasons. Some of them have to do with technology and economics and migration and other things. America doesn't have that. We don't have sort of cuisine, or if we do, it's like the cuisine of technology. It's like the cuisine of the freezer and the drive-thru.
Right.
And, you know, there's something about that of course is exciting because it means it's a blank slate and you can fill that space with all sorts of new weird things. But I think there is part of it that's challenging too. And I experienced that challenge, and I think Lois experiences that challenge. And yeah, that I think that line is maybe this character Bayo trying to tell her that it's not all frustration.
Right.
It's actually an opportunity as well.
So to talk about Lois for a minute, she works on software for robot arms. And this is technology that in her mind and in the mind of her employers will eventually take over repetitive tasks. And most of her job, she describes as solving problems. But when she starts on this repetitive task of baking, she finds that she's dealing with the same problem over and over again. And she says this line that I just love. She says, maybe the problem is the point. Is there intellectual value in the sort of repetitive labor that's likely to be replaced by robot arms?
So, wow, it's a really good question. And I'm not actually going to take the easy road, which I think is to like affirm the value of like, of course,
Okay. You
know, yes, wax on, wax off. Like it is good to practice things and to like bake a loaf of bread every day or to, you know, knit a sweater and then another sweater and, you know, sweaters as far as the eye can see. I mean, I think it's obvious that those things are pleasurable and people do them. I will tell you, I think this is a slightly more complex way of thinking about it, or a subtler way of thinking about it, that I, as someone who kind of came out of the world of technology, and of course now I'm in the world of writing and books, I've always been challenged by those things, by those kind of tasks. You know, every time I've ever made dumplings or any kind of dumpling from any cuisine around the world, which is like, and it's because I'm a bad dumpling maker. Each one takes me like 5 minutes to like kind of pack the filling in and make the little folded edge. And I'm doing it and I'm like, this is a bad trade-off. I'm spending 5 minutes on this dumpling and I'm going to eat it in like 2 seconds. And I don't know, it's like, of course, it's fun to do. It's fun to do in a group, sitting around a table. But I feel that sort of, couldn't something else make this dumpling for me? I could go read a book, you know? I could go write a book. Because, of course, there are these other things, software, books. You do it once, you know, you do the work, and then it can be reused and redeployed and re-experienced essentially an infinite number of times. And it's not like being a chef making dumplings or baking a loaf of bread where, you know, you give it to someone and they enjoy it. And you're like, that's great. You enjoyed it. Now I have to make another one.
Right.
I just find that trade-off and that tension really, really endlessly fascinating. And yeah, I tried to put that on the page.
I mean, I think about that sometimes in terms of the history of books, there's a place in the past where that merges, where if you wanted to give somebody a copy of your book, you had to write out another one rather than just pop down to Bookmarks and buy one off the shelf.
That's right. That's right. No, that's a really good point. And so, I mean, maybe, I'm sure that it is the case that part of the history of people and our tools is a march into not just mechanization, but yeah, making it sort of easier to do things over and make more copies for people. I mean, there's no question though that, it's not a transparent process. We do lose things along the way. If we had a perfect dumpling making machine, the dumplings would not be the same as the ones made painstakingly by me, you know, at the table over the course of 5 minutes. And yeah, you gain things, but you also lose some things,
right,
too.
Right. I mean, I think, again, in all of these things, one of the things you gain is uniqueness. That whether it's a manuscript or a dumpling, if it's made by hand, everyone is going to be, by its very nature, different. Whereas the point of automation is to try to make everything the same.
Right. And of course, there's something about that that's wonderful and democratic. You know, the whole history of publishing, in particular, I often think of like the paperback and the paperback revolution of the early part of the 20th century. I mean, you know this well. There are still people who like will barely affirm that a paperback is really a book. They're like, oh, it's so flimsy and gee, what a piece of junk. But of course, they're amazing because it suddenly opens up, you know, books to people in places that would not necessarily have had access or would not have been able to afford them or wouldn't have had a place to put them. Like suddenly you can slide it into your back pocket if you're someone who actually works and you can't just sort of, you know, recline in your study with your huge volumes all the time. So yeah, it's complicated. Yeah. It's just a complicated process.
So San Francisco, you talked a little bit about a particular street in San Francisco, but to me, San Francisco is also a character in your books. I mean, both of your books are very deeply rooted in San Francisco. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with that city.
Well, you know, I am a transplant. I'm from Michigan originally. I grew up in the suburbs around Detroit. I went to school at Michigan State University. And pretty quickly after that, not immediately, but pretty quickly after school, I found myself in San Francisco. Not in the way that a lot of people do, which is to say, they've long imagined it, you know, for some reason that city and that place has always kind of been shining on the horizon and they knew they had to get there. I didn't really have a concept of the city, to tell you the truth. I hadn't been to California as an adult ever, and I went for a job. And if that job had been in Winston-Salem, I would have moved to Winston-Salem in a second, or say St. Louis or Saskatchewan or anywhere. As it turns out, I feel really lucky that it was in San Francisco, particularly to have drawn me there at that time, the early 2000s. Because it was and is an exciting place for all the reasons that people understand. You know, there's all this technology stuff happening that's sort of changing the world in like enormous ways, and it's all kind of issuing forth from the wellspring there in Silicon Valley, and also because it's a physically beautiful place with a Z-axis and really nice weather. But also because, especially coming from Michigan, the cultural baseline sort of feeling about risk and failure was so very different. In the San Francisco Bay Area, there's just a really strong culture of taking risks and being totally fine with things not working as you imagine they will. And indeed, like the great things that you can learn from that. And I found that as someone from the Midwest, from more conservative culture, dominated by big companies and long careers in those big companies, I found that totally bracing and exhilarating.
The novel I'm working on right now has a scene in San Francisco on the day of the earthquake in 1906. And as I was researching that, I was reading about some of the plans that were proposed after the city was devastated. And this opportunity early in the life of a city to sort of completely reinvent yourself, which in a way they did, but in a way they didn't. Does it feel like a city that has that capability of reinvention?
Well, some people say, and I think they're probably right, they say that San Francisco is the permanent boom town. Its history, pre-1906, comes from being kind of the way station, or its early existence comes from being the way station on the road to the gold fields, basically a place where people would bring back all their money and spend it. you look at menus, it's really funny, you look at menus from restaurants kind of from that early, those early gold rush days, and truly the prices for drinks, for omelets, are higher, not in inflation-adjusted terms, in like pure dollar terms, they're higher than they are even now in 2017. And you just can't, they're like, what, was that like buying a car? Was ordering an omelet like buying a car in, Gold Rush, San Francisco? So that's continued, and there, it's been different things that have kind of propelled it, but I do, it's not a normal city. Like the Bay Area taken as a whole, I think is honestly a little healthier as a community, as a group of people all living together and kind of figuring it out. San Francisco as this particular node is pretty weird, and I think it is. It's that boom and kind of constant almost demolition and reconstruction, whether that's in literal terms or kind of more metaphorical economic terms, that makes it interesting.
Well, I think, you said San Francisco was weird, and that brings me to a question about some of these spaces that you write about. So Mr. Penumbra's bookstore is not like any other bookstore any of us have ever seen. The Merrill Market, which is a food market in the novel Sourdough, was unlike any farmer's market I've ever been to. Do you feel drawn to these kind of bizarre spaces?
Oh, I mean, definitely, of course. And I think that's, I wish I could actually say that springs from some sort of deeper literary understanding of the world or some vision for the region. I don't think it does. I think that is purely a function of the kind of books that I have always read and loved, which always have secret doors and passages and hidden caves, full of crystals and whatever, cupboards that open into kingdoms. And, I haven't written that kind of book exactly yet, but I do think there's a way of doing that almost portal fantasy in the real world. And usually that means opening the door into a strange bookstore.
So are there actual real physical places either in San Francisco or elsewhere that you've gone into and said, wow, this is just the kind of weirdness that...
Yeah, no, there definitely are. I mean, San Francisco, I think, probably has a higher stock of those, certainly per capita, than anywhere else I know of. I mean, there are truly places where, I'm thinking of a specific example, a place called the Secret Alley in San Francisco, completely unremarkable door in the Mission District. You would never open it if you didn't know what was inside. It opens into a real bleak-looking staircase. Again, if you didn't know where you were going, you would like turn back like, ugh, this is too creepy. If you keep going, though, you find almost like a movie set built inside this building. It looks like a little cobblestone alleyway up on the second floor with these tiny shops. The shops are all kind of the size of this room or smaller, and each one is something different. Some of them sell things. There's one that broadcasts this amazing and strange internet radio station. It's a tiny little sort of perfectly crafted world up on the second story of this bleak building in San Francisco. And of course, what makes it remarkable is that by San Francisco standards, it's not that strange.
That's perfectly normal. Right? When I read your books, I feel like I'm in the hands of somebody who's a master at making these, on the surface of them, bizarre fictional conceits seem completely real and normal, whether it's singing Sourdough Starter or something else. And one of the things, I find myself looking things up to go, is that real or is that not real? One of the things that I loved was the idea of the Lois Club. Is that something you completely invented, or is that based in any sort of reality?
Oh, no. I have to tell you, I'm sure that you have a similar process or a similar kind of thing in your life. A notebook, and maybe it's real, maybe it's digital, but kind of just a repository for all the interesting things you run across. You want to kind of keep track of those because those become fuel for who knows what kind of stories in the future. One of the things that went into my notebook years ago after a conversation with a friend of mine, a great... a journalist actually named Lois Beckett. She mentioned to me very casually the existence of this Lois Club in the real world. And I just went, there's a Lois Club? Hold on, I have to write this down. So I did write it down. It's one of those funny things, you know, it's not that I imagined this story from the beginning, like, of course, and the main character will belong to a club of people with the same name. Like, no, of course that's not it. Instead, first she was a character, then only about, you know, somewhere midway through the process did she become a character named Lois and not something else. But then as soon as that happened, of course I remembered the Lois Club and it had to become part of that world.
So if we have any listeners out there named Lois, you can run out and join the Lois.
Yeah, Google it. You'll find it. It's actually a really wonderful kind of frozen in time web page. It looks like one of those kind of great old web pages that maybe was created in the late 90s and hasn't been updated very much since.
It's amazing to me when I'm doing research how often something pops up that I didn't realize how perfect it was going to be for the book. The reality is more perfect than what I had imagined I might discover. Can you talk a little bit about the research you did for this book? You talked about looking at menus. What sort of archives did you go to find about the history of food in San Francisco?
Yeah, the truth is that for this book, I did more of that, what I think of as kind of traditional book novel research than I had ever done before. And actually discovered kind of the peril of it. I don't know if you've had this experience yourself. I have now learned that doing research for your novel, well, listeners can't see, but I'm making sort of dangerous air quotes, doing research for your novel very quickly becomes like the most high class form of procrastination. and of course it's all fascinating. I mean, it's so interesting. And so you just end up with this like, you know, pages and pages and pages. You know, there's like these huge virtual kind of webs of all this information, and you're sure it's going to all go into the novel. It's going to be amazing because it's so wonderful and astonishing, but it can't all go into the novel because what novel would that be? It would be like 9,000 pages long. So in some ways, what I learned was not how to do the research, but how to stop doing the research and just like push back from that particular buffet and write the book because there was too much.
Yeah, I find sometimes I get obsessed with getting things right that either the information doesn't even exist, or if it does exist, it's in such an obscure place that it's pretty unlikely that a reader's going to say to me, well, actually, the L trains on the 6th Avenue L in 1906 ran every 15 minutes and not every 12 minutes.
Right.
But I'll spend hours, you know, trying to figure it out.
It's a fine balance, though, because I understand that impulse as well. Even on kind of a broader scale, you think about writing about technology, for instance, you know, maybe you're going to include something about code or computers in your book. You never want to be that person who writes about it in such a sort of clumsy, sort of superficial way that anyone who knows anything about the subject just rolls their eyes and says, oh, great, another novel or movie that treats computers essentially as magic. And you can, you know, substitute other things there. Maybe
sure.
It's not computers. Maybe it is a particular part of history. Maybe it's something about, you know, politics. Maybe it's something about cooking. So I think it's better to have that impulse, I think, than to not have it, because it at least kind of puts you along the right path, even if you do have to stop yourself at some point from like booking a train trip to New York just to like check the archival timetables for the subway system. But you do have to imagine those few people, and they are, I mean, you can probably count them on two hands, who will ever read one of these books and see that. And they will so appreciate it. They will so appreciate it that it might actually make it worthwhile.
Yeah. And I do think there are times when we have to remind ourselves that we're novelists. We're not writing a work of nonfiction or a work of history, but we might be using history in that context. And for me, getting those little facts right simply makes it, I think if it feels more real to me, it'll feel more real to my reader.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there is, I mean, I think that has to do with suspension of disbelief, actually.
Yeah.
So maybe more than, in fact, contributing to the story, what you're doing is you're making sure there are none of those little, you know, I don't know what to call them, landmines or little, you know, sharp burrs on the tabletop that kind of poke people and bring them out of the story.
Right.
You never want to do that.
Right.
That's it. And we've all had experience reading and kind of going, huh, what? That's not, no, that you've never been to San Francisco, or you've never used a computer. And those just, they do. They yank you right out of the story. You feel like if the writer didn't take the time to get that right, well then, like, what else did they kind of cut corners on? And is this book even worth my time?
Right, it'll cast doubt on everything else.
Yeah.
There's a line in this book that says, "The world is going to change, I think, slowly at first, then faster than anyone expects." Would you like to elaborate on that?
That's a very San Francisco Bay Area line, isn't it? It is. I try not to be a techno-utopian because I don't think that this stuff leads us inexorably into a better world or better lives. And, you know, I think our relationship with the internet and social media over the last few decades shows that. I mean, it's transformed our lives and it's made really amazing, delightful, positive things possible, but it's also corroded a lot of things, the way we spend our time and the way we relate to one another and our political system and all sorts of other things. But the change is undeniable. And there is this sense, you hear Silicon Valley people talk about this a lot. If you think about an exponential curve, you know, one of these kind of steep slopes that we all learned about in school and kind of learned to plot on our graphing calculators. If you're sitting on one of those slopes, it turns out, they always look like a straight line. You kind of look up and you look down and you're like, ah, here I am, you know, and it's, I see the direction, I see where we've come from and I see where we're going. It's only when you zoom out that you're able to see that it's not a straight line with kind of a predictable path. Instead, it's this really remarkable shape that goes and gets really steep really fast. And, you know, I think that's a place where historians and technologists are actually kind of united. And that's not always, I feel like usually they're on the opposite side of arguments. But in this case, I think they're united in saying, watch out, because change is not linear. And the world can get really weird really fast. And that's something I like to remember and talk about when I can.
So Lois is trying to get her robot arm to crack eggs. Do you think anybody's going to ever get a robot arm to write novels?
That's a great question. The answer is yes, but very, very badly. So I think we're safe for now. You know, I've actually been very deeply interested in the progress of machine learning and artificial intelligence over the last few years, and it's that interest that flowed into parts of this book. Separately and like after I finished the manuscript for Sourdough, I've continued to kind of dabble with those tools and explore what's possible. And indeed, I have even trained myself some very, very simple artificial intelligences, so dumb that they almost don't deserve that name, to write. And you can, it's really an amazing process. You can train them on a corpus of text of your choosing. It could be, you know, all the great novels of the 19th century, or it could be all the emails you've ever sent, and, you know, anything in between, or all those things and more. And then based on what they've learned, you can ask them to write something for you. And I'll report to you now the state of the art, which is interesting and happily not threatening. They can write really good sentences. The sentences that these things spit out, there's one particular AI that I trained on science fiction stories from the middle of the 20th century, like real kind of classic pulpy science fiction. And it writes interesting, beautiful sentences, often with a syntax and kind of a construction that surprises me. And I kind of go, ooh, I like what you did there, computer. And I think that stuff is useful. You know, I think that could become material. I think it could become a way to kind of prompt a human's writing, or it could kind of flow into something that a human can write. The good news is that after you get past about a sentence or maybe two sentences, these computers, they lose the thread. It's like a dream that never quite coalesces, and they can just keep writing and it can keep going and going and going, but it never really goes anywhere.
Right.
So at least for now, if you want a story that goes anywhere and has something to say about the world, that's still the domain of humans.
Stick with us. So we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. They're very short answer questions, but hopefully they'll give us some insight into not only writing, but into Robin Sloan.
Great. So, I love this. I love a good lightning round.
Okay, here's the lightning round. What word do you love to work into your writing?
I think it's got to be, it's probably a class of words. Anytime I can mention an elf, dragon, goblin, or wizard, in a non-fantasy context, I'm proud of myself.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Limn. L-I-M-N. Limn.
Where is your favorite place to write?
My favorite place to write is my little office in an industrial park in South Berkeley.
Where could you never write?
I could never write in a perfectly quiet, still, hermetically sealed room.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Well, the answer is probably the proper conjunction of sentences and words using semicolons, but I think that's only because I don't fully understand them.
Right. What was the first book you remember reading?
First book I really remember reading and having a strong, strong reaction to has got to be The Chronicles of Prydain by Lloyd Alexander. It's an early reading memory, and it's also the first book I remember closing and feeling so, so sad that it was over.
What are you reading now?
Oh, what am I reading now? I am rereading, actually, a book that I read in galley form a few months ago and really, really loved. I'm kind of preparing myself for its release. It's a novel called Autonomous by the writer Annalee Newitz, and it, too, has a lot to say about robots and humans and their relationship with robots, and it's coming out soon in September 2017.
What book that someone else wrote would you like to have written?
What a great question. There's no way to answer that without be sounding so sort of audacious, is there? There's a vibe I aspire to. I don't know that it's exactly a book, but there's an atmosphere that the science fiction writer William Gibson conjures in a particular set of three books. One's called Pattern Recognition, and there's a few more that kind of flow on from that. And it's just this sort of mix of a sci-fi novel that somehow is set in our time, not the future, and it's cool and gleaming, and it reads almost like a spy thriller, but there are no spies in it. And I just, it's perfect. And I would love to be able to conjure that kind of feeling in one of my books one day.
So this is a related question, but what sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think the answer is actually some sort of historical fiction. Mm-hmm. I actually just finished an amazing work of historical fiction by Alan First, a novel called Dark Star that I'd never really heard about before. I picked it up by chance and was totally engrossed by it. And completely in awe of its, you know, kind of conjuring of this particular historical time. I don't think that I just have the skills or the inclination to pull that off myself, but I'm such a fan when it's done well.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
What would I like to hear a reader tell me? I think the answer is that they picked up the book even though it's not the kind of thing they usually read. So maybe they picked it up with a little bit of skepticism or uncertainty, but then by the end they loved it. I think that's always the most satisfying thing.
That's great. This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. My guest today has been Robin Sloan, whose new novel, Sourdough, is available wherever books are sold. And of course, you can get signed copies from Bookmarks. Robin, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Join me next time on Inside the Writer's Studio with a live broadcast from Bookmarks. I'll be having a lively conversation with Holly Goddard-Jones about her new novel, The Salt Line. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.